The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Where have you been? It's been so long since I've been behind this mic. I've missed it, but I'm back at Edstone. We've had lots and lots of subs filling in. In fact, I had a nice email that came in yesterday, one who said, I enjoyed Andrew Locher, Richard Palmer, Sam Livingston, Brent Noctegal, and Dwight Falk on the radio show last week. They all did a great job. This listener writes, and I was so pleased to listen to each. Indeed, they all have a passion for God's work. So we had the subs lined up last week, and then again yesterday with Richard, and we certainly do appreciate the effort and work that went into those programs. While I was off with the family, we were in Charlotte, North Carolina for Passover and for the first day of Unleavened Bread. And we actually flew into Washington, D.C., which is a good ways away from Charlotte. But we did that because, for one, it was cheaper, but also we were anxious to just do a little bit of driving through Virginia. And so before the Holy Days and then after, when we were working our way back to Dulles Airport yesterday, we were able to see Jefferson's Monticello. That was, I guess, about a week and a half ago. And then on the same day, we went, I think it was about an hour and a half south of Monticello to Appomattox, where Ulysses S. Grant and General Lee concluded the Civil War. This is the site, the famous McLean House, where the United States came together and started the process of healing those deep and bloody wounds from the Civil War. And then just yesterday and the day before that, we visited Colonial Williamsburg over on the other side of Virginia, up along the coast. Williamsburg is, I think, about 15 miles from Yorktown, which we also saw yesterday, the American Revolution Museum in Yorktown. Well worth the visit. If you get a chance to visit that part of the United States, that museum is it's one of the best museums that I've seen. So, and of course, lots of exciting history there as well, and lots of anniversaries at some of these historical sites. Richard and Sam were showing me some of the headlines this morning regarding the upcoming 75th anniversary of D-Day. And we've been actually looking at the possibility of going to Normandy for that that time period around June 6th, which is not that far from us. But we just learned today that that President Trump is scheduled to make his first official state visit. This is going to be one much, I guess, much more official and bigger than the one, what was it, about 2 years ago, I guess. But he's coming right around the time of the Normandy anniversary as well. So there's going to be quite a lot going on down around Portsmouth. This is from Richard just today. The visit from the president will culminate with a major D-Day commemoration event in Portsmouth, which will involve military displays and tributes to the Allied troops who fought in Normandy in the Second World War. It says Downing Street said the event would be one of the greatest British military spectacles in recent history. So we may have to scrap our plans to Normandy and just go to Portsmouth. We'll see. It was funny just trying to look for hotels. I don't think there's an available hotel within about 50 or 60 miles of Normandy there in northern France. So there's lots of celebrations, I guess, lots of commemorations, lots of events for that special 75th anniversary, both across the English Channel and, as we now see, on this side as well. So we have something that we can certainly venture out to see, hopefully, in the early part of June. Of course, early June is also the time for the Cardiff Pack. That's out in Wales. I guess it would be southern Wales. And as of this morning, we had 48 people registered for the first day. I think that's Sunday, June 2nd. And then the second day, Monday evening, right now we have 32 people registered. So that's a fair bit closer to the London area than Belfast or Glasgow. So there's a good chance that we could have a bigger group, a much bigger group than those two previous packs that we've had up north. So lots of exciting events as we work our way through the spring holiday season. And then soon after that, finish off the school year for AC and then carry on with some of the exciting summer activities. I can tell you one thing I'm very excited about now that I'm back after some busy travel on the East Coast of the United States. I'm very thankful for Edstone, for the peace, the quiet, the traffic-free environment, trying to get from Yorktown yesterday up to the Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. I think it was about 120 miles. It ended up taking about 4 hours, just stop-and-go traffic the whole way, just in the mid-afternoon. I don't think it was anything unusual as far as it being rush hour or anything. But mid-afternoon traffic, and we barely got there in time to catch our plane. And then I don't think I've ever seen Heathrow here in London as busy as it was this morning, just packed at the customs agents or the customs lines, and then packed in coming out as well of the airport, people with their luggage and moving on to their vehicles and such. Maybe with it being the day after or the second day after the Easter weekend holiday, maybe that added to the numbers. In any event, once you you work your way through a lot of that noise and congestion and pollution and delays here and there, it does certainly make you very much appreciate God's campuses, whether in Edmond, Oklahoma, or here in beautiful Edstone. Well, speaking of the Easter weekend, you had these coordinated attacks in Sri Lanka. I guess the death toll now is up to 300 or so, with about 500 people that have been wounded because of these many explosions. This is another email we got from one of our listeners who wrote yesterday, "As you may know, we have several brethren in Sri Lanka, a couple of whom have homes just 100 meters from the the main explosion, I can't pronounce the name, but it says, and who were only a few kilometers away during the blast. These brethren were fortunate enough to attend the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day in Baguio City, Philippines, last fall, where we met them, and which was their first ever feast after several years in God's church. It says, the mostly Buddhist Sri Lankans are asking, why here? Why now? What's next? Were the bombings a counter to the recent attacks on Muslims in Christchurch, New Zealand? Well, you have to wonder if this is retaliation. It says, how blessed we are to have a loving father who protects his sons and daughters, and what an honor we have to back and support his work in these last years of man's self-rule. That's from one of our listeners down in the Middle East. Someone that attended a feast site last year where he met some of our brethren from Sri Lanka. 300 people massacred on Easter Sunday, just a couple of days ago. I thought it was interesting over at Newsbusters, just to compare this with the way that the New Zealand attack was covered in the mainstream media. That happened, several weeks ago, I guess. But that was a case where there was a white supremacist who went into a mosque and murdered all of these Muslims. And, of course, that got quite a lot of coverage. This one, though, the Sri Lankan bombings, you can expect this to disappear from the headlines here in the next day or two. Newsbusters pointed out that last night, CNN had these, they aired five back-to-back town halls with all these 2020 Democratic candidates. And that would have been, Monday night? So the day after all of these attacks in Sri Lanka, and not one question for any of those Democratic candidates about the massacre in Sri Lanka. There were all kinds of questions about impeachment, of course. Impeach, impeach, impeach. They can't let that go. Even now that the Mueller report is out, even now that the report has been released and there's no collusion. And how do you obstruct justice if there's no underlying crime to go with it? Now they're trying to read into all of these tweets by President Trump or things that he might have done. He almost did this. He said he wanted to do this. And that's what they're hanging their hat on now. Even though, as the report brings out, there is no collusion. But, well, we can't very well say that he didn't obstruct justice. And so here's this report, basically just giving the Democrats a little more fuel for their fire to go after and to go after this president and to try to take him down. But you just look at the facts as they're presented in this report. And then you see in these town hall meetings last night, you see what the news media people are concerned with most. They don't care. They don't care. Not when it's an attack like this one. If it was a white supremacist, of course, that'd be all over those town halls last night. But because that doesn't fit conveniently enough into their narrative, they just brush that aside and go on and on and on about impeachment. Hear the evidence. The facts are in. And yet still, you had, I think, eight total questions about impeachment at these town halls last night on CNN. Well, CNN, mostly it's fake news. Mostly it's far to the left. But I thought this one was interesting. A bit of truth. I guess a broken clock is right twice a day at least. This is from CNN. Mueller's report looks bad for Obama. Wow. We don't hear that very often. The report is out now. And who looks bad here? Well, actually, it's Barack Obama, says at least one commentator. It says the partisan warfare over the Mueller report will rage. But one thing cannot be denied. Former President Barack Obama looks just plain bad. On his watch, the Russians meddled in our democracy, while his administration did nothing about it. Now, that's the truth. That's the truth. You just look at the time. You look at the chronology. You look at the main players. You look at when Russia started to meddle. And you have to ask. You should be asking, where was Barack Obama? What did Barack Obama do? Well, he did nothing. You remember that soundbite? We've played it so many times. Where right before the election in 2016, he just said, well, no serious person really could think that Russia could ever influence our elections. They're too decentralized. There's no way that they could influence it one way or the other. And, of course, all of his people very quickly changed their tune as soon as Donald Trump won. Then, all of a sudden, it's a big problem. And then they go on and blame Donald Trump, of all people. He wasn't even in office. There he was, winning this election. A stunning turn of events. And then he's just in the transition period, putting together his administration there in November and December of 2016. And out comes Brennan and Clapper and all the rest of them, Jim Comey. saying that not only did Russia try to help Donald Trump, the two were colluding together. And we heard that for 2 years. For 2 years. Then the summary comes out a few weeks back. Then finally the report. No collusion. And yet what do you hear last night on CNN? Impeach, impeach, impeach. What about impeachment? What about impeachment? It won't stop. Going back to this CNN piece, it says the Mueller report flatly states that Russia began interfering in American democracy in 2014. And who was the president at that time? That's me adding a thought there. 2014. It says over the next couple of years, the effort blossomed into a robust attempt to interfere in our 2016 presidential election. The Obama administration knew this was going on and yet did nothing. In 2016, Obama's national security advisor, Susan Rice, told her staff to stand down and knock it off as they drew up plans to strike back against the Russians. That's right. That's the Obama administration. That's the Obama White House telling their security officials, telling their security apparatus, don't you strike back at Russia. Remember, this was the same administration that just said, well, go ahead and take over Crimea, if you like, and do what you will in Syria. It's all yours. And yet there are journalists today with a straight face that say it's Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump who's working, who's colluding with Vladimir Putin. Back to this article, Susan Rice, she's there. She's saying, look, stand down, knock it off. Don't strike back. It says finally in this CNN piece, if you consider Russian election interference a crisis for our democracy, then you cannot read the Mueller report, adding it to the available public evidence, and conclude anything other than Barack Obama spectacularly failed America. If you just read it, honestly, if you just read it in search of the truth, how can you conclude anything else other than this is a spectacular failure on the part of Barack Obama? This commentator says subsequent investigations of this matter should explore how and why Obama's White House failed and whether they invented the collusion narrative to cover up those failures. Why didn't these moderators ask in those five town halls last night? Why didn't they ask about Barack Obama and how bad the Mueller report makes him look? They're not going to ask that. It's just going to be all things Donald Trump. And then they wonder why it's President Trump taking to Twitter to get his message out there. Look at the coverage. Look at how lopsided it is. Look at how unfair and biased it is. The president, by the way, he tweeted this morning, I wonder if the New York Times will apologize to me a second time as they did after the 2016 election. Remember that? It was so biased. It was so ridiculous. It was so one-sided in the direction of Hillary Clinton that the New York Times had to come out after the election and apologize to its readers. And so here's the president bringing that up again, that recent history, saying, I wonder if they're going to apologize a second time for all of this collusion nonsense. The president said, but this one, this apology, will have to be a far bigger and better apology. It says on this one, they will have to get down on their knees and beg for forgiveness. They are truly the enemy of the people. That's President Trump going to work early this morning, as he often does, fighting back against the liberal left-wing media. Well, one final story here before we take a break. This has to do with the royal family here in the UK and the rift between the one young royal couple, Harry and Meghan Markle. They've been married, I guess, for almost a year now. And then on the other side, of course, you have William and Kate. It says courtiers are concerned by the gulf between Harry and Meghan's modern ways and those of the future king and queen. This is from the Times of London. It says further on in the piece, the origins lie in that separation of the two offices, a move more than half a dozen sources attest, driven by a recognition that the two men, that's Harry and William, the two men will have very different constitutional roles in the future, and the growing personal differences of approach between them and their wives. So it's not exactly a secret anymore that these two couples, they're not exactly hitting it off. It says, after a year in which Harry and Meghan have hardly been off the front pages, it would be natural for William and Kate to feel somewhat overshadowed. It was not long after the office split that the tabloids started reporting that Kate and Meghan did not see eye to eye. They first separated as far as their office space is concerned, and then the reports start coming in that the two ladies, weren't seeing eye to eye. It says they were very different people, one report suggested. And then further on, it says, a number of those preparing William for the throne share this view and have openly told friends that Meghan is a nightmare. And it goes on to explain some of the scandalous history from the mid-1930s involving the royal family. But I'll just work my way here to the conclusion. Listen to this. It says, it's something that has not gone unnoticed by MPs. One senior Tory said, the death of the Queen, whenever it is, will be a moment of massive public mourning. Most people can't imagine singing God Save the King. It will create 2 or 3 years of gentle national psychological confusion. Queen Elizabeth, she's been in there since the early 1950s. God Save the King. It's hard to even imagine singing that. But listen to this, and again, consider some of the things that my father's written over the last 2 years or so regarding the royal family and the throne here in Britain. It says, the same happened when Queen Victoria died. If the royals are then found to fail, I think the whole thing could come crashing down remarkably quickly. And of course, we've talked about some of these other reports in recent years, about what was it that Harry told Newsweek, that nobody really wants to rule on the throne after Elizabeth, after his grandmother. But here is a commentator at the Times saying that if this fails, it's going to happen fast. Well, you put this together, as I say, with so much of what God's given to his church in the last couple of years, specifically about the new throne and stone, and it's not surprising at all. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a study through some of the passages or chapters in Exodus having to do with the plagues. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Who and what is God? That is a mystery not understood by any religion, not explained by science, untaught by higher education. The intellectually vain originators of the evolutionary theory found the existence of God, as presented by religion, a mystery they could neither understand nor accept. But the religionists, whom they rejected, did not themselves understand the mystery of God. Yet God does reveal himself through his word, the Holy Bible, if these religionists would only believe God's own revelation. It is only in this inspired book that God reveals himself. But mankind in general has never believed God. That is, what God says. Mystery of the Ages explains the Bible. In this book, you will find answers to the most perplexing questions of our day. We offer it to you, the viewer, at no cost or obligation. Request Mystery of the Ages today. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
You know, when you read in Bible history, you find all the way through that God was reminding the Israelites of how he brought them out of Israel, out of the land of slavery and captivity. I mean, out of the land of Egypt. Out of slavery and out of captivity. Now, Egypt, spiritually and symbolically, that is, in the Bible, typifies sin. And its pharaohs typified the devil. And their soldiers and their army, the demons that beset us and trouble us and all that sort of thing. There's a great lot of symbol about it and giving us a picture that is for our instruction and admonition today in these days of grace. Because the things that happened to them way back there in Old Testament time were examples for us. Always there, it was physical, but it's an example of the spiritual application in these days of grace in the New Testament now. And so, always they were reminded of coming out of Egypt. And their coming out of Egypt, my friends, is the type for the Christian in the days of grace of how Christ brings us out of the bondage of sin. Egypt was the type of sin.
That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his old radio programs, talking about all of these vivid types, these analogies that we can take away from that Old Testament history. Paul, of course, tells us in 1 Corinthians 10 that the examples are there for our learning. It's for us today. And the reason the history of Israel's exodus from Egypt is so relevant to the people of God today is because we're coming out of Satan's world. We were all born as a captive people in Satan's world. He's the god of this world, 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. And Mr. Armstrong would talk about that, of course, in Ephesians 2:2 and other passages like that, Revelation 12:9. Satan as the god of this world, the prince of the power of the air, surcharging the air with his attitude, with his moods. And, of course, we have a carnal nature. Human beings have it. Mr. Armstrong explained that we're all automatically tuned into it, Satan's wavelength. And that's how we so very quickly become enslaved to sin. And there's only one way out of that captivity. We have to be miraculously delivered, just like the Israelites of old. Slaves can't free themselves. They need a miracle. That's what it took in the book of Exodus for the people of God, the people of Israel. And that's what it takes for us today. Hebrews 8 and verse 9 says that God took the Israelites by the hand and led them out of Egypt. He intervened miraculously to spare them from sure death. That's in Exodus 12. I don't want to get ahead of myself because there's a lot that happened even before that. When you think about all of these plagues, God just pounding the Israelites, or rather the Egyptians, so that they would let the Israelites go. And then, of course, God, like that verse in Hebrews brings out, God took them by the hand and drew them out. Just one miracle after another miracle after another miracle. Let's look at some of this history. This is Exodus chapter 4. And verse 22 it says, "And you shall say unto Pharaoh, Thus says the Eternal, Israel is my son, even my firstborn, This is God giving instructions to Moses about his people. You go to Pharaoh and you tell him, Israel is my firstborn son. You know what a firstborn is. It's the one that comes into the family first. And if you understand the full extent of God's purpose and plan, you understand and know that there's other nations, there's other peoples that are coming in second and third and fourth and so on. But Israel was to be the model nation, the example. And here again, we can take away some powerful lessons from this history. When you consider that we, like Galatians 6 says, we're the Israel of God. We're spiritual Israel. God's church. Verse 23 says, and I say unto you, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay your son, even your firstborn. Here God tells us right at the start where all of this would lead. All of these plagues, it would culminate in what's recounted there in Exodus 12. If you don't let my firstborn go, then I'm going to kill your firstborn. And so God is setting things up in order to paint a very dramatic picture with Passover and all that followed thereafter. There's a lot of depth to these events. There's a lot of lessons to draw from these events. Well, the last part of chapter 4, Moses meets up with, after receiving these instructions from God, he meets up with Aaron and tells Aaron everything, and the two of them are on board with this plan, with these instructions from God. And notice chapter 5, Exodus 5 and verse 1, it says, and afterward Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness. Let my people go, so that they can go and worship God. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go. Who is this God you speak of? And why should the people of Israel go out to obey this God that you talk about? Verse 3, it says, and they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Let us go, we pray you, 3 days' journey into the desert, and sacrifice unto the Eternal our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. And the king of Egypt said unto them, wherefore do you, Moses and Aaron, let the people from their works get you unto your burdens? You're not going to go out and obey the God, your God, in the wilderness. You're here to obey me. You're my slaves. And so here is Pharaoh's heart hardening. Verse 5, and Pharaoh said, behold, the people of the land now are many, and you make them rest from their burdens. And Pharaoh commanded the same day the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no more give the people straw to make brick, as heretofore. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. And the tale of the bricks, which they did make heretofore, it says, you shall lay upon them. You shall not diminish aught thereof. So basically, he's just piling on more work. Moses and Aaron go and say, look, let us go and worship our God. And he says, no, you're gonna stay here and actually do more work, more labor. Verse 10, it says, and the taskmasters of the people went out in their offices, and they spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go you, get you straw where you can find it. Yet not aught of your work shall be diminished. And so at the start, it looked like it went from bad to worse for these Israelites. Here they thought they might be delivered, and yet it turned into a greater trial and test, at least initially. Verse 20 says, and they met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way, as they came forth from Pharaoh, And they said unto them, The Lord look upon you and judge, because you have made our savor, says, to be abhorred in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to slay us. And Moses returned unto the Eternal and said, Lord, wherefore have you so evil entreated this people? Why is it that you have sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all. So the people came and complained to Moses. They condemned Moses, really. And so Moses had this continuous struggle, this fight on his hands. On the one hand, he had the fight with Pharaoh in Egypt. And then on the other hand, you had Israel, his own people, who were fighting him, attacking him, criticizing him. So he goes back to God and he says, What's the plan here? I don't understand. How's this going to work out? Chapter 6 in verse 1, it says, And the Eternal said to Moses, Now shall you see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. And God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Eternal. And I appeared unto Abraham and Isaac and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty. It says, But by the name Jehovah was I not known to them, and I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. So God told Moses about this important history, how that he established the people of Israel there because of this covenant he made with Abraham, their father. Verse 5 says, And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore, say unto the children of Israel, I am the Eternal, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments. Just go to these people and reassure them. I will intervene. I will perform miracles. Just tell them to trust me. Tell them to obey me. Verse 7, And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and you shall know that I am the Eternal your God, which brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Don't you worry. I'll follow through. I'll keep my word. I'll keep my promise. He was about to demonstrate his awesome and mighty power. But these people, as you know, they really did struggle to obey God, to trust God in faith. Now, there's verses in the Old Testament, too, that talk about their heart. They didn't have the heart to obey. They didn't have God's Spirit yet. They didn't have Jesus Christ living in them. Verse 10, it says, And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Go in, speak unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, that he let the children of Israel go out of his land. And Moses spoke unto the Eternal, saying, Behold, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. How then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips? How Moses just felt like he was in this impossible position. Like I say, he was getting it from both sides. Verse 1 of chapter 7, it says, And the Eternal said unto Moses, See, I have made you a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. Here again, just keep in mind that God's setting the stage now for this dramatic type of our conversion. That's what this represents. That's what this pictures. Even 1 Corinthians 10 brings that out. It says in verse 2, this is chapter 7, You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall speak unto Pharaoh, that he send the children of Israel out of his land, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. Here, this is in chapter 7, and God says up front, Look, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and then I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. I'm going to harden his heart. This is what it says in the Good News magazine, March 1982. It says, remember that Pharaoh was carnal, and that the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. That's from Romans 8:7. It says, this stubborn, determined despot epitomized carnality. He made it quite clear, had boasted even, that he was not subject to the law of God, neither indeed would be. God could have softened Pharaoh's heart suddenly and dramatically by intervening in his life. He could have, but he didn't. This article goes on to talk about how God, he did do that for Saul, who became Paul on the way to Damascus. But he didn't do that with Pharaoh. He didn't soften his heart. And that's because he wasn't ready to call the Egyptian ruler or the Egyptian people. Notice verse 4, it says, but Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt, and bring forth my armies, and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. It says, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal, when I stretch forth my hand upon Egypt, and bring out the children of Israel from among them. So you see why God here is setting it up the way that he did. He also wanted to reveal his mighty power. He wanted to declare his name before even the Egyptians. This is history. These are lessons that we can take away from it as spiritual Israelites, but it also tells us something about the God, the great creator God, who made all of mankind. And we all have the potential, as I say. There's the firstborn, and then there's the second, the third, and the fourth. But here God sets up these events, all with this plan of revealing himself, not only to the Israelites, but to the Egyptians too. That's remarkable. Over in chapter 9, Exodus 9 and verse 15, it says, for now, I'm just jumping ahead to reinforce this point. Verse 15 says, for now I will stretch out my hand, and I will smite you and your people with pestilence, and you shall be cut off from the earth. And in very deed for this cause have I raised you up, for to show in you my power, and that my name may be declared throughout all the earth. So all of these plagues that God brought upon Egypt, it was to declare God's name throughout all the earth. It was to show the Egyptians God's power. This was a message not for Israel alone. This was a message for the whole world. God hardened Pharaoh's heart in order to reveal himself to Israel, to Egypt, even the whole world. He hardened Pharaoh's heart because of what these events for our time picture. These events picture for today. He hardened Pharaoh's heart because these plagues in Egypt actually foreshadowed the plagues God is going to send during the day of the Lord. You can read more about that at the end of the book, in the book of Revelation. Plagues are coming again on our people today, on this world today, and again, God is going to declare his name. God is going to reveal his power. Exodus 10 and verse 1, it says, and the Eternal said unto Moses, go in unto Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I might show these my signs before him, and that you may tell in the ears of your son and in your son's son what things I have wrought in Egypt and my signs which I have done among them, that you may know how that I am the Eternal. So God used these events once again to establish his reputation in Israel, in Egypt as well. In chapter 12, this is the Passover chapter. This is, again, we're just bouncing around a little bit to try to get the big picture here. It says in verse 12 of chapter 12, for I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and will smite all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. See, God was going to personally execute judgment upon Egypt, upon the Pharaoh and his people. And he was doing it, of course, through his servant, through his prophet Moses. Over in chapter 14, again, verse 3, it says, "For Pharaoh will say, he will say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land." This is after their departure, their miraculous departure from Egypt, from Goshen. And then they went down and they were in this apparent trap. Mountains on the one side, and of course the Red Sea. But here God is setting all of this up. "The Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they're entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he shall follow after them. And I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Eternal." And they did so. Here again, this is for the Egyptians as well, that they might know that God is the Eternal. You read through this history and you see, yes, there's a firstborn, that's true, but you see God's plan. It runs right through these events, this history. The fact that God is going to convert all of mankind into God beings. God is a family. And everyone who's ever lived will have their opportunity to be born into that family of God. He's going to eventually offer a chance for salvation to every human being. Let me just read to you a couple of verses in the New Testament from Romans 9 before we conclude here. It says in verse 17, Romans 9:17, "For the scripture says unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised you up, that I might show my power in you, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth." God keeps this big picture in mind. His purpose. He wants his name to be declared over all the earth. And so he worked with Pharaoh back in the days of ancient Israel to show the Egyptians, to show the whole world that he is God. Verse 22, this is from the paraphrase, the Living Bible. Romans 9:22 says, "Does not God have a perfect right to show his fury and power against those who are fit only for destruction? Those he has been patient with for all this time," verse 23 says, "and he has a right to take others such as ourselves, who have been made for pouring the riches of his glory into, whether we are Jews or Gentiles, and to be kind to us, so that everyone can see how very great his glory is." God wants to save everyone, Jews and Gentiles. He really has thought this through. He really has laid out this plan perfectly. What we see here in this history, it's an extraordinary picture. And one that we want to be thinking about it, especially at this time of year. You go back to that soundbite that I played at the start of the segment. Mr. Armstrong talking about all the types in the Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days booklet. It says, if Egypt is a type of sin, then surely Pharaoh must picture Satan, the army of Egypt, Satan's demons. And on it goes. And again, the lessons to take away from this, the fact that Pharaoh was so reluctant to let the Israelites go. Satan doesn't want to lose his grip on us either. Satan doesn't want to let us go. But there's another quote in that Pagan Holidays booklet that says that when God intervenes, like he did in Exodus 12, when he intervenes miraculously, Satan has to release us. Satan has to let us go, but he doesn't just let us go and then close up shop. He comes after us. He wants to destroy us. And we have to be people of faith who follow God in faith, who trust God, total faith. They made that mistake, of course, in the Old Testament, or rather they didn't have the faith that they needed to trust God and to follow God. They got out in the wilderness, and then right away they started to complain, to grumble, to criticize. Well, when we continue this this segment, we'll get into this again tomorrow. I think this is a good enough breaking point. Before we start in with Exodus chapter 7 and then chapter 8, and we'll just go through some of the specific plagues and see how that it culminates in the events of Exodus 12, the Passover, and the night to be much observed. Many of us just finished celebrating the night to be much observed at the end of last week. And of course, before that Passover, lots and lots of lessons, as I say, to take away from this incredible history. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any and all comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.